Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is war. Our subject today is modern warfare, and specifically cyber warfare. Now, if you're of a certain age like I am, this very concept sounds like science fiction, but as is so often the case, science fiction has become science fact. And many of our wars, or something that looks very close to war, many of those things are being fought not with machine guns, not with bombs. So certainly those things are still out there, and certainly we're very concerned about them, but much of what we would normally call warfare is being fought over computer lines, is being fought over the internet, and it's already here. In fact, it's been here for some time. And I've had the pleasure recently of speaking with an expert in this subject. His name is Joseph Nye. He is the dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, one of the most respected voices in the field of national security. And he's recently written a book in which he devotes an entire chapter to the emerging threat of cyber warfare and what the United States should and perhaps isn't doing about it. In the studio with me today is another expert. His name is Benjamin Harris. Hello, Ben.
Hey, Dad.
And Ben has volunteered to come in and as a representative of the younger generation to whom all this stuff is second nature. Ben has done a little bit of research for me on another cyber threat that's very similar to the ones that Professor Nye will tell us about. What are you going to tell us about in a few minutes here?
The hacker group, Anonymous.
Anonymous. Internet vigilantes who may very well take down our entire computer structure, right?
Well, maybe. We really don't know.
We'll find out from Ben in just a few minutes. But in the meantime, let's go talk to Professor Joseph Nye, the dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. I wonder if you could begin just by telling us, what is this? What's a cyber attack? What is cyber warfare?
Well, the words attack and warfare are used pretty loosely.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people say, you know, there are millions of cyber attacks. Well, that's true if somebody just probes another computer to find out what's going on. If you call that an attack, then we're deluged with them every day.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, people will say, well, there was, a headline in the New York Times this year that says Israel and Egypt escalate cyber war, and it was somebody, an Israeli defacing an Egyptian website, and an Egyptian defacing an Israeli website. Well, you know, that's not really war. I mean, it's a nuisance, perhaps.
A cyber dust-up.
Yeah, and that, so in that sense, when people say, have we seen cyber war, probably not. I mean, it's in the sense of a real cyber war. A lot depends on how you define war. I mean, again, war is a metaphor that we use loosely. We talk about the war on drugs and the war on poverty or war between the sexes and so forth. But if you take war seriously and put a higher threshold on it as a lethal use of force or in terms of international law, an act of war is something that violates the territorial integrity and political sovereignty of another country, then we probably haven't seen a cyber war. The closest we've come is this attack on the centrifuge program of the nuclear enrichment program in Iran.
Oh, the Stuxnet virus.
Stuxnet. Mm-hmm. That essentially did destroy things inside another country, so it violated territorial integrity. And it was in the context of a campaign in which some Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated, so the Iranians may say that this looked like war to them. Others would say, well, no, it's just sabotage. It doesn't reach the scale that we'd call war. So we're on the, if you want, the fringes of cyber war, but we haven't yet really seen a major cyber war.
Right. I guess a major attack would be like the one people always mention fearfully, if somebody in Iran retaliated for the Stuxnet virus, assuming it came from the United States, and launched their own virus, which would disable the cooling systems in one of our nuclear reactors, and that resulted in a meltdown. I guess that would qualify.
That would probably qualify if it led. I mean, what the U.S. government has done is said that we will basically use a definition similar to the UN definition, but the question of whether it's war or not will have to do with the amount of damage that's done, what's sometimes called kinetic damage or physical damage, as opposed to just electronic. And that would be determined by the president saying that this has reached that level. So it's a little bit fuzzy when you cross this border into what really would be a cyber war.
Well, let me ask you, is that border even still relevant or appropriate in the modern world? You can do a lot of damage to a nation, to its infrastructure. It doesn't even necessarily involve physical damage. If you simply go into a country and mess up its electrical grid, even if you don't blow out a single transformer, if the electrical grid's not working for an extended period of time, that's a lot of damage that you've done without hurting anything physically.
That's right. You can do a lot of damage by essentially putting a logic bomb into an electrical grid so that it doesn't work. And
yeah,
if you do that in Chicago in February and the pipes freeze, that'll do a lot of physical damage, just as though bombs had gone off.
Well, I guess my point was that you don't even really have to do physical damage. If you simply had a virus that was infiltrated into a country and it just simply erased a whole bunch of important computer records or
That's another example, which is if you erase important information,
right,
that can do a great deal of damage.
So I guess that brings up the question, is that still a relevant delineation then? Is physical damage still the appropriate trigger to call something a war, or can it be some lesser definition?
Well, I guess the way the Defense Department is using, if you look, the Pentagon issued a statement last November, a report, the DoD cyber space policy report in November of last year, in which they talked more or less about costly disruptions, even if they're non-lethal. If they're costly enough, that can be the sort of the equivalence of kinetic damage. So they've been careful to reserve the right to respond not just electronically, but also physically, depending on how they perceive the type of damage, how much damage is done. So if you erased all the computers that control air traffic, you would obviously lead to crashes. But suppose that it was done in a way when planes weren't flying but couldn't fly then, that could cause enormous damage to the economy. Or if you erased the information that underlies the financial system, so the financial system couldn't work, that can do enormous damage, costing billions of dollars and so forth.
Right.
And if that's the equivalent of what would happen through a bomb, then according to this Defense Department doctrine of sort of kinetic equivalence, that might be declared a violation of our territorial integrity or in the equivalent of a war.
Okay, would it be fair to say then that a cyber attack or cyber warfare is any sort of attack that comes over the Internet and that causes very significant damage, whether it's physical or not? I mean, is that a reasonable definition?
Yeah, I think the key question there is the costly disruption. I mean, how costly is it?
Right.
And how much damage does it do? So, yes, we know that you can make a transformer or a centrifuge spin so fast that it blows itself up physically. But if you prevent any of these transformers working so that there's no electricity, that also can cause a very expensive disruption. Can be similar on that. So there's some lines that have not yet been crossed and which are somewhat vague, which but which are declaratory policy, the way we say what we're going to do, have made it clear that if you get into that range, we will respond not just electronically, but reserve the right to respond physically.
Yeah. Let's talk about one thing that allegedly the United States had something to do with, and that's the so-called Stuxnet virus. I wonder if you could tell us as much as you know about that, or as much as you can tell us about what happened with Stuxnet. What was
Well, we don't. I mean, the details of Stuxnet are classified, and I don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the leading account has been in the new book by David Sanger, the New York Times correspondent, and he's also reported in the New York Times, in which he describes Stuxnet as a program that has been undertaken by the United States and Israel to essentially sabotage the centrifuges in the Iranian nuclear enrichment program, and it's an effort to slow down Iranian progress toward building a nuclear weapon by depriving them of the centrifuges which produce the highly enriched uranium that you would need to make a bomb. And
let's just pause there, and for the people who are not familiar with nuclear weapons technology, the key part of constructing a nuclear weapon, and perhaps the most difficult part of constructing a nuclear weapon, is taking natural uranium and enriching it, that is, concentrating the particular isotope that you need to a high enough degree that you can actually construct the bomb.
That's right. What you do is the uranium that comes out of the ground won't go bang.
Right.
But if you get, if you are able to separate the uranium-235, that isotope, from the uranium-238 and concentrate it, then you can get a concentration which will sustain a chain reaction and create a nuclear explosion.
And that's very technically difficult to do and very expensive, and the centrifuges are a key part of doing that, at least by one method. And therefore, that's where the Achilles heel is of almost any large-scale nuclear program is, you know, if you can disrupt the centrifuges, then you can at least slow down the progress of the Iranians, in this case, toward getting enough bomb-grade material to actually construct an explosive device.
That's right. I mean, according to these public accounts, that's what the Stuxnet virus was designed to do. It was based on control systems produced by the German manufacturer Siemens, and the again, according to these public accounts, by looking at how the Siemens control mechanisms were regulating the centrifuges, you could program them so that it looked like they were doing their normal job, but they were actually telling the centrifuges to speed up very fast or to slow down too quickly, and that would mean the centrifuges would spin off their axes or would blow up, essentially.
It basically just tore them apart, didn't it?
Yeah,
and I don't want to make light of this at all, but it sounded really cool. I mean, it's a sort of a James Bond thing.
Yeah, if your goal is to stop Iranian progress toward a nuclear weapon without dropping bombs from the sky, which is one of the alternatives, you could argue that this is a step in the right direction from the point of view of the Americans or the Israelis, not obviously from the point of view of the Iranians.
Right. It was ingenious, and there's a part of me, a part of most people probably in this country who think, well, that was really cool to do, but I'm sure the Iranians thought of it as pretty darn close to an act of war. And
well, it looked at from the Iranian point of view, it must look close to what they would see as unacceptable damage. Though, thus far, as best we can tell, the Iranians haven't replied in kind.
As best we can tell. Well, let me ask you this now. Let's bring it back to the Constitution, which is always our theme. Let's assume that that President Obama authorized this, or maybe before, maybe this goes back to President George W. Bush or earlier. Let's assume that one of those presidents authorized this and that, President Obama authorized its deployment. What gives him that authority? I mean, what gives him the authority to go out there and actually start physically destroying facilities in other countries with which we are not technically at war.
Well, it under the Constitution, according to the Sanger book, this starts in the last year of the Bush administration, and then it's continued by the Obama administration. Under the legal authorities, this would require a finding for a covert operation. So the CIA would come to the president and say, we have this security threat, national security threat of Iran developing a nuclear weapon. We think that we can sabotage this by the following procedures, but this would be a covert action, and a covert action requires a finding under a certain part of the United States legal code, which mm-hmm. has been passed by Congress. So there is a constitutional procedure authorized by Congress and signed off by the president for this. I believe these findings are usually briefed to the chairs of the relevant intelligence committees in the Congress or the top leadership. So there is a constitutional procedure for
it. Okay, so Congress is at least involved in passing the statute, which authorizes this procedure in the intelligence community, this finding of a threat, and is perhaps even later involved at least in the intelligence oversight function that it exercises. And so this is not an entirely unilateral executive action, but it certainly represents an enormous delegation of power to the executive to identify these threats and somewhat aggressively pursue them.
Yes, that's true, but it's not unprecedented.
Oh, no.
That we've had covert actions throughout the Cold War. So
the first time I heard about this, I'll tell you, this reminded me of something that Alan Dulles would have really enjoyed.
Well, that's probably true.
You know, he was just for those who are not as policy wonkish as I am, Alan Dulles was the first really notorious director of the CIA back in the 1950s. And he was the one who always was pushing these sorts of covert operations. They were not intelligence gathering. They were actually overthrowing foreign regimes, you know, Iran and Guatemala. And I guess Bay of Pigs was where it all went awry from his perspective. And this is what it really sounds like. It sounds like an updated Alan Dulles covert, let's go out and destroy the bad guys policy.
Yes. In the 1970s, though, in reaction to some of the excesses of covert actions of the 50s and 60s, Congress passed a set of laws which established procedures which essentially required these notifications. So covert actions have been going on for a long time, but since the 70s and the there's been a set of procedures for notifying first the president. And then the president has to notify the Congress.
Okay. So at least we've got some involvement of Congress. We've got Congress at least acquiescing in some sense in these sorts of things. And so I guess that's as far as we're able to address the constitutional issue. Congress is involved, and so arguably if there's a declaration of war that's required, that's about as close as we're going to get, at least under these circumstances.
Yeah, well, I think the argument here would be that these actions, these covert actions, are short of a declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they fall in this gray area that's below the threshold, which requires war, though it's also worth noticing that full-scale declarations of war have not been something we've seen for decades.
Oh, no. No, it's just that generally speaking, when we talk about that and that fact, that there have not been these declarations, somebody will still point to some action by Congress, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin resolution or the authorization for use of military force after 9/11, that Congress somehow gets involved and blesses the executive's decision or desire to go forward into Afghanistan or Iraq or Vietnam or wherever. And I guess that's just as close as we're going to get in this circumstance, and we just still have this fuzzy divide ahead of us. One wonders at what point a president would actually look for a more formal declaration from Congress before going ahead with a cyber attack. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're discussing warfare, specifically cyber warfare, with University Distinguished Service Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr., the former dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard University. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Professor Joseph S. Nye. Stay tuned.
Time for the quiz, mein Führer. I'm sorry, Mr. President. It's time for our quiz. And here in the mine shaft, we have with us Kelly Carmichael.
From now on, I'm going to make sure your coffee cup is filled with water.
I will fill
it up for you.
It's time for the constitutional quiz with Kelly Carmichael from James Madison's Montpelier, and we're just having a blast today, and we want to quiz somebody. So who do we have on the line?
My name's Brent Heist, and I'm from Haddonfield, New Jersey.
From Haddonfield, New Jersey.
Where is that in New Jersey?
It's right outside of Philadelphia, where Professor Harris went to school.
Oh,
right
tremendous. Wow, yes, that is where I went to law school, and Philadelphia is a city that is near and dear to my heart, as is the entire state of New Jersey. So thank you for joining us, Brent. And Kelly, what do you have?
All right, Brent, I have a question for you. Here we go. Citizens vote for their representatives in government. Which of the following statements from the Declaration of Independence best reflects this principle? Is it A, among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? B, all men are created equal. C, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Or D, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
Wow.
Can I hear the question one more time, please?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Citizens vote for their representatives in government. Which of the following statements from the Declaration of Independence best reflects the principle that citizens vote for their representatives in government? And the first answer choice, and we'll just stop there, is A, among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Okay, so it's a Declaration of Independence question. We know that's not part of the Constitution, but we also know that the concepts in the Declaration are very important to us as Americans. So I think this question is asking, you know, which, when you vote, when you go out and you vote for your representatives, which of these statements from the Declaration is closest to what you're doing, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so what part of the Declaration is most closely related to the act of going out and voting for your elected representatives? And the first one was which statement?
A, among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
What do you think about that one? Is answer choice A a good choice?
I don't like it.
You don't like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
It's just not my thing. I just don't like it.
He's a pessimist. He's a dark pessimist. He's from New Jersey, after all.
He's from New Jersey. I mean, that has to explain everything.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, well then, what's answer choice B, Kelly?
B.
I really hope that A wasn't it.
Well, this is not your final answer. We're just talking now. We're just talking. Okay, go on.
All men are created equal.
Okay. I like that one better, but
it's because
like
it's the men
the
part.
I like it when men are equal. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, you like that one better? Is that what you think that'll be your choice or not?
No, I don't. It doesn't. Not 100% on that one.
Doesn't float his boat. Okay.
No,
what about C?
All right, C, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
Oh, I like that one.
He likes it. Why do you like that one?
I like that. Well, they're getting their powers from people from voting, so they're getting their powers from the governed, which are the people, and they're voting for the government.
Oh,
interesting.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, well,
I don't even know. Well, I don't know. That one's sort of... And you said on the previous radio show that it's usually C.
We have a regular listener. All right, what about D?
D, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights.
That one sounds okay, too. I guess with certain endowed by their creator. I guess I'm going to go C.
Because that's what I said the answer choice is before.
Based solely on it's either B or C.
It has to be B or C. Well, what is it? How did it work for Brent? How did Brent do?
All right, Brent.
I doubt I did well.
You doubt you did well?
I'm very nervous. I'm sweating up a storm over here.
You're sweating.
I am concerned that New Jersey people don't like life, liberty, and prop in the pursuit of
happiness. He doesn't like that.
But
he
I think that's the problem of the state itself.
Oh, okay. All right.
It is. Oh, you go across to Pennsylvania, you're fine. It's just Jersey.
Yeah. I see. Well, how did Brent do?
Brent, congratulations. You did it right.
I did. Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was a hard question because you could argue that all men being created equal is part of voting. You know, everybody gets to vote. You could argue that pursuing happiness is something you do through participating in government, you know, trying to make your life better. But the one that's most applicable, you really hit it on the head, was, you know, governments derive their powers, their just powers, from the consent of the governed. And that's what you're doing. I mean, when you go out and vote, you are consenting to the outcome of the election, whether your guy wins or not. The act of voting is essential to our form of government. So even though we're not required to vote, it's one of our most important rights, and it goes all the way back to the Declaration of Independence. So, Brent, thanks very much, and congratulations.
Thanks so much.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to Professor Joseph S. Nye of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and we're talking about the very serious subject of cyber warfare. When we left off our discussion, I was just asking Professor Nye, how do we make the decision to launch such an attack?
Well, one of the more difficult questions related to cyber attacks is what will be the rules of engagement, not for something like this full-scale sabotage of the type we are describing when we describe Stuxnet, but what happens if there's an incoming attack on American computer systems? To what extent do you have to go to the president to get authority to respond? Cyber attacks can occur of that sort can occur very, very quickly. So it's conceivable that the National Security Agency, which is in Fort Meade, Maryland, and decrypts foreign intelligence operations, might see something coming toward an American computer, American government computer, and say, we want to prevent this from actually disabling or implanting this malware in the computer. If they had to go to the White House and convene a deputies meeting and so forth, it would be too late. I mean, some of these attacks happen in 300 milliseconds. So then the question is, would you want to have rules of engagement which would say, if you see this kind of attack and it has these characteristics, you can act, and if you see a different set of attacks and they're different characteristics, you can't act. Right now, rules of engagement are quite strict. And the United States, if it sees an incoming attack, can try to avoid it, but it can't immediately retaliate. And so there is an issue there of how would you want to see rules of engagement established in a world in which cyber attacks are almost instantaneous.
Big issue. In fact, it brings up a whole other issue, and then the question that I'll just ask you is how well prepared are we, generally speaking, for the threats that we think we face?
Well, not as well prepared as we'd like to be. There's sometimes people say that they divide this world into what's called .mil, that is, internet addresses that end with a military URL or Universal Resource Locator, and then there's .gov, those which are related to the United States government, and then there's .com and all the others, which are the vast majority of the Internet. So .mil and .gov are, you know, 10% perhaps of the Internet, but most of it is in the private sector and has addresses like .com or .org or .education and so forth. And those areas are not very well protected. I mean, some areas, for example, the banking system, banking, financial services companies will take efforts to protect themselves. But generally speaking, we're better off in the area of .mil, not as well off in the area of .gov, and not very well off at all in .com.
Hmm. And, of course, that could all do great damage to the economy and to other parts of the country as well, you know, if it came in against one of those sorts of addresses. Let me ask you this, to shift the focus slightly. What about deterrence? Are we in a position to be able to, at the very least, identify who launches one of these attacks? So even if we can't stop it, we're in a position to retaliate, and do the bad guys know that? So can we theoretically deter them from this?
Well, it depends what bad guys you're talking about. If you're talking about another major country, China, Russia, so forth, I think there is deterrence. For one thing, people sometimes say that there can't be any deterrence because you aren't sure where an attack came from.
Mm-hmm.
But in practice with other major governments, we often have a fairly good idea of where the attack came from. It may not be good enough to serve in a court of law, but it may be good enough to serve for a threat of retaliation, which would provide a degree of deterrence. But in addition to that, there's something you might call deterrence through entanglement. If you say, well, what's to stop the Chinese from suddenly turning off all our electricity and destroying the American economy? You could say, well, what's to stop them from suddenly selling all the trillions of dollars that they hold and destroying the value of the economy by dumping their dollars? The answer is that such actions would bring us to our knees, but would bring them to their ankles. In other words, it's self-defeating. The Chinese have enough of an investment in the American economy doing well that they don't want to do that. So to damage us badly would be to damage themselves. And that might be what you call self-deterrence.
Mm-hmm.
Deterrence through entanglement.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of the flip side. We make ourselves vulnerable by being so interconnected internationally. But on the other hand, the more that interconnection grows and the more we become interdependent on each other, then the less, at least, likely it is that a state actor like China or Russia or Iran perhaps even would engage in that behavior for the very reasons you described. But that, of course, leaves the non-state actors and the terrorists, that leaves them still out there, doesn't it?
That's where the problems of deterrence get serious. In the book that I published this past year called The Future of Power, there's a chapter on what I call the diffusion of power, and not among states but to non-state actors. And there we don't have answers. I mean, the problem we see is that non-state actors, particularly in the cyber realm, are able to do things which previously were reserved largely to states. So
mm-hmm.
The chapter I have in the book on cyber power describes the powers that states have and then the powers that non-state actors have. And non-state actors are getting close to being able to do a lot of what states can do. And yet, because we won't have a clear idea of who they are or where their home base is, it'll be much harder to retaliate. I think that worries a lot of people. And I think that is where we have a harder time wrapping our minds around this diffusion of power to non-state actors.
Well, what's the answer to that? I mean, given that there are a lot of people out there who are willing to do some very nasty things to advance their goals...
Well, the answers are several. I mean, there are things that we need to do to clean up our own networks. For example, a lot of Americans are not careful about their antivirus software, easily penetrated. Their computers can be recruited into botnets, which are armies of computers that are seized quietly, if you want.
Right, somebody turns your computer into a zombie and then uses it to launch a denial-of-service attack or something like that? Mm-hmm. Right.
So, one thing is better computer hygiene. Another would be to allow Internet service providers, that's the Comcast, the ATTs, and so forth, to alert consumers when their computers are infected with malware. And if the consumer doesn't do anything about it, to allow a temporary stopping of service. That's not legal now, and it's much more controversial. But there are things you can do in computer hygiene to reduce some of the opportunities that are opened for non-state actors. The non-state actors, some of them are highly sophisticated, and as I mentioned, approach the capacities of government. But the largest part of them are less sophisticated, and you can sort of remove that that low-hanging fruit by these hygiene-type things. Another thing you can do is basically develop more resilience. In other words, if something does occur, have the ability to back it up or quickly repair it so that it doesn't do as much damage as would otherwise be the case. And then there are issues of ways in which different parts of the economy, I mentioned earlier the banking sector and so forth, can have higher standards within their own industries. So there are a series of things that can be done, but the bottom line of this is that we don't have adequate protection against non-state actors, and it's not likely to happen soon.
All those sound like very good suggestions, but they bring up another very significant constitutional issue, and that's, of course, privacy. And if the government is going to encourage this sort of thing and is going to authorize Internet service providers to be a bit more aggressive in policing their clients, et cetera, I imagine there's going to be a lot of information there that the government's going to be either gathering itself or authorizing other parties to gather, and that brings up a lot of civil liberties issues, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and there are two layers, if you like. One is the ability of Internet service providers to look at overall patterns of data so that you can see. You don't look at what's in the messages that are going over the Internet, but you just notice that there's a suspicious number of messages coming from an address, let's say in Russia or Ukraine, that's been associated with malware in the past. And that sort of large-scale data analysis raises less privacy concerns because it doesn't look inside the packets to see what the message is. Mm-hmm. But then there's also a question of should you permit deep packet inspection, which is to allow the government, or if not the government, private actors like Internet service providers to look inside these packets, which constitute the substance of the messages, to see whether something is malware or not. And that's where the privacy issues tend to get more sensitive. Yeah. And where there's a considerable debate going on right now in the Congress and differences between a House-passed bill and the administration on this.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Joseph S. Nye of Harvard University about the very serious subject of cyber warfare. I don't know. This is all too modern for me. I think we need to go back a couple hundred years and have our Madison Minute, maybe take a quick break, and then we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and maybe then I'll be ready to come back and talk about this disturbing modern subject of cyber warfare. Stay tuned.
James Madison was the last prominent member of the founding generation. Several founders, including Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and James Monroe, had died on July 4th. Adams and Jefferson shared the additional distinction of dying in 1826, the 50th anniversary of the nation's birth. Madison's doctors were fully aware of this, and they would have prolonged his life until the 4th of July, or at least have made the attempt if Madison had wanted them to. But Madison would not be unnecessarily stimulated and died in the full possession of all his noble faculties. Upon learning of Madison's death, Daniel Gold wrote to Dolly Madison, "By this, we are deprived of the last of those great and good men, the founders of the American Republic, the last of those living examples of a patriotism and self-devotion without a parallel in history. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
Now it's time to hear what's happening this week at Montpelier. But you know, this week we're going to hear about something you can do every week, and that is you can always go and visit Dolly Madison's garden.
The sunlight and the vista, just the setting is so remarkable. We're looking out. We're standing at the top end, and so it's sort of spread out beneath us. You can see all the way to the bottom gate there. And then beyond that, the land falls, and then it rises up, and then there's a mountainside framing the distance. This is just spectacular.
Well, one of the things I never take for granted here is the fact that no matter where you are on Montpelier, other than the Blue Ridge Mountains, you're looking at Montpelier land. So mm-hmm. we do own up over what we call now Chicken Mountain.
Chicken Mountain. Why is mm-hmm. it called Chicken Mountain?
DuPonts actually had chickens there.
I see.
So we'll
okay.
just leave that alone.
Okay.
It's had many names in the past. Currently, it's Chicken Mountain. But as long, once again, as we are good stewards of our own land, the view shed, the integrity of that view shed will remain as it is today.
Well, wasn't that just pastoral? I'm not much of a garden guy. I have to admit that. But that's one garden I enjoy. Didn't you hear the birds tweeting? It was so lovely. It just makes me in the mood to, oh, yes, let's talk about cyber warfare again. In fact, let's finish our discussion of the implications, the very serious issues raised by this issue of cyber warfare with Professor Joseph S. Nye of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. It reminds one, of course, of what you hear coming out of China. And they seem to have a very aggressive internet policing policy, obviously for reasons that we don't support in this country. They're very actively trying to suppress a great deal of speech over there. Do you know much about that? How effective
are
they?
Chinese have tiers of controls on the internet. One is there are filters, which when messages are coming in to China from outside the country, they go through certain gateway computers, and these computers have software on them that says if something mentions Tiananmen Square, drop the message or censor the message, so that when you go to your computer somewhere in Shanghai and you type in Tiananmen Square, it says, you know, the screen comes up and says, you know, this there's nothing on this. So that's one layer. Then below that, the Chinese use their internet service providers, the various Chinese companies that provide services. They tell them that they're not supposed to convey messages on issues like Falun Gong or let's say Tiananmen Square or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the internet service providers know that in a repressive system like China, if they don't obey, they're going to lose their government support and their clientele and so forth. And then a layer below that is people who are actually police who are looking over the messages on the internet, some of the police, some volunteers. And if somebody is continually exchanging messages on taboo topics like the ones we mentioned, then you can have the police come to the door and knock on the door and say, knock it off or you'll be under arrest. I don't see that kind of control ever happening in the United States because it's a different political system. I mean, it wouldn't be tolerated. So I think the analogies of what's being discussed now in Congress about should we let internet service providers alert consumers to their, or require them to tell consumers about whether they're infected or not, should you allow better protection in the United States. I can't really see this becoming a Chinese-like system.
Well, that's certainly a relief, because the Chinese system is one nightmare scenario, and of course the other one is the one we've been talking about, some devastating cyber attack on our country, and you don't want either one of them to happen. And
right.
It sounds like it so often does with these civil liberties issues, is that you're trying to strike that proper balance between security and freedom.
Well, it's exactly right. They're a set of difficult trade-offs, and we haven't figured out exactly where to strike that balance yet, we as a country.
Right. Well, any final thoughts on cyber attacks or cyber warfare?
Well, I think the most important would be that people are going to have to start paying attention, because in a democracy, legislation on issues like this is going to require an part of the citizenry to be informed enough to be able to tell their senators and congresspeople what they want. And until recently, until the last few years, this has been an area of so much secrecy that it's been difficult to have proper democratic debate about it. So I think the fact that some of these issues are now coming out into the open, though people worry about them, I think it's necessary for progress on figuring out where we are in this democracy.
Indeed. And to that end, to become informed on this subject, what's the title of your most recent book on this subject?
Well, the book is called The Future of Power, and there's a chapter in there on cyber power.
Okay. You've also written an article called Cyber Power, published by the Harvard Kennedy School. That's available on the Internet for free download as well. It's a very good paper. It's about 20 pages long, and it's very, very readable. And I'll recommend it to people. You also mentioned David Sanger's book on the Stuxnet virus, right?
Right. Yeah, I think it's, I can't remember the full title of it, something like, something about concealment. It's about Obama's foreign policy, but there's a chapter in there on Stuxnet.
Well, a brand new problem, but an age-old prescription. In a free society, it's our responsibility as citizens to inform ourselves and engage in the debate, and that's what we're going to need to do. So, Dr. Joseph Nye, thank you so very much for talking to us about this important topic.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much to Joseph Nye, Jr., the University Distinguished Service Professor and the former dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. That was a disturbing but fascinating discussion of cyber warfare and some of its modern constitutional implications. Of course, cyber warfare is the sort of thing, as I discussed with Professor Nye, that doesn't have to be launched by a government. In fact, it's perhaps more probable that private actors, hackers sitting at their computers in someone's basement somewhere, will launch an attack, and that attack may be just as damaging, just as deadly, perhaps, as one that could have been launched under the auspices of a government. And so I have asked a member of the younger generation, a fellow I know fairly well, by the name of Ben Harris, to come in today. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
Hey, yeah, it's nice to see you, young man. Despite his reticence at the moment, Ben is, you have to allow a father to brag. He's going to start at the University of Virginia this fall. He has been selected for a Jefferson Scholarship, and is going to be studying in this area, I think, probably. What do you think, Ben? You think you're going to study politics and history and government and that sort of thing?
Between the parties, I think I'll have enough time.
Between the Well, before he gets inundated with all the parties that happen in Charlottesville, I've asked Ben to do some serious research and on a subject that he suggested. And what's that subject you're going to tell us about, Ben?
Probably one of the more influential hacker groups out there, the group called Anonymous.
Anonymous. What is this group, Anonymous?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Anonymous is more of an umbrella term that covers a wide array of individuals. With similar goals and similar methods, but not much coherent organization, and certainly no leadership structure.
So it's sort of a non-group.
Yeah, pretty much.
And what does this non-group do?
Well, in their own words, they're focused on promoting access to information, free speech, and transparency. So they'll take on a wide array of different crusades against certain groups.
Right. Such as?
Well, the one that got them famous was their attack on the Church of Scientology, which began back in January of 2008.
Really? Okay, well, these sound like a group of internet vigilantes, then.
Almost. I mean, they've actually done vigilante things. Like, they shut down 40 child porn sites and then gave the names of the users to the FBI.
Oh, okay.
So they've actually done vigilante things. This campaign, however, began as a protest against the Church of Scientology's methods of silencing, you know, opposition and dissent.
Uh-huh. And how did they announce themselves? I mean, how do you know that Anonymous is after you?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell, but in this case, they made it pretty clear. You see, the church was censoring videos that it released about Tom Cruise, you know, requesting sites like YouTube to remove them or edit them and, you know, threatening lawsuits.
Okay, I think I remember this. So Tom Cruise did a video for the Scientology Church, right?
Exactly. He was a little crazy.
Pre-Katie or post-Katie?
This was pre-Katie. He had Scientology to talk to.
Okay.
He claimed that Scientologists were the only people who helped after car accidents and were the authority of getting people off drugs.
Sorry.
So, obviously, after the church released it, they wanted to take some of it back after comments. So in doing so, they caught Anonymous's attention because
they tried to shut down they tried to force websites to not post this embarrassing video anymore.
Exactly. Okay. And Anonymous used some of the websites and they were upset about this because they're very strongly against censorship. So they created a video entitled Message to Scientology and posted on YouTube, letting the church know of its intentions.
Hello, leaders of Scientology. We are Anonymous. Over the years, we have been watching you, your campaigns of misinformation, your suppression of dissent, your litigious nature. All of these things have caught our eye. With the leakage of your latest propaganda video into mainstream circulation, the extent of your malign influence over those who have come to trust you as leaders has been made clear to us. Anonymous has therefore decided that your organization should be destroyed. For the good of your followers, for the good of mankind, and for our own enjoyment, we shall proceed to expel you from the internet and systematically dismantle the Church of Scientology in its present form. We recognize you as serious opponents. In fact, it is encouraged. We are your SPs. Over time, as we begin to merge our pulse with that of your church, the suppression of your followers will become increasingly difficult to maintain. Believers will become aware that salvation needn't come at the expense of their livelihood. They will become aware that the stress and the frustration that they feel is not due to us, but a source much closer to them. Yes, we are SPs, but the sum of suppression we could ever muster is eclipsed by that of your own RTC. Knowledge is free. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
Good grief, Ben. I feel like sending a distress call to the Enterprise. We've sighted the Borg.
Well, you know, Anonymous has sometimes itself referred to as a collective because they sort of operate within the same parameters.
That was scary. I should mention we didn't play the entire audio from that video. It's about 2 minutes long, right? And where can people find that if they want to access that?
Just go to YouTube. It's called Message to Scientology.
Message to Scientology. Okay, so that's how Scientology burst into most people's consciousness, right?
Oh, that's how Anonymous came on the scene.
Oh, excuse me. Anonymous, not Scientology. Okay, so Anonymous did. So what happened with that? What did they do then to the Scientology church?
In the following week, they launched a series of DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service attacks against the church's website.
Okay, explain that. What is that?
Well, to simplify, what a DDoS attack normally involves is getting many computers to overload a server. And you can do this with something called a botnet. Now, my cheap parents didn't buy me a computer till I was much older, so I'm not familiar with a lot of the terminology. But basically what a botnet is you get one computer and then go and find a bunch of other computers that are not being used and then recruit them into your general force to go and overwhelm the servers of a particular website. Actually, for this, people could download an attachment called the Low Orbit Ion Cannon, which allowed their computer to be used by Anonymous in these DDoS attacks.
So if I wanted simply to allow my computer to be part of this attack, say I'm not a hacker, but I'm sympathetic, then I could just download something and then Anonymous could then come in and take over my computer.
And use it, yeah. They succeeded for about a week or two, taking out most of the church's websites. The church was actually forced to relocate to a server that specifically specialized in defending against these sorts of attacks.
Wow, that's remarkable.
But afterwards, in a much more notable event, on February 10th, Anonymous used their their internet resources to launch an actual physical worldwide campaign against the church. And so on February 10th, over 7,000 protesters in 93 cities worldwide went and picketed their local churches of Scientology wearing the anonymous Guy Fawkes masks that were popularized by the movie V for Vendetta.
Oh, I've seen those. That was the guy with the mustache?
Exactly.
Okay, so the Guy Fawkes mask, and then they put those on, and then...
They got signs, protested the church, and tried to raise awareness about the underhanded methods of the Church of Scientology.
I see. Very interesting. So they use the internet to actually have physical action. I guess that's... I've heard of things called flash mobs, and I guess this is somewhat similar to that, right?
Oh, no, this is actually organized for a purpose.
Okay, well, flash mob, yeah, more just silly for the most part, but this is an organized protest, and... In fact, that sounds very similar to some of the stuff that's been going on in the Middle East, doesn't it?
Yeah, Anonymous has also been active in the Middle East. One of the things they did is during the Arab Spring, they took out the websites of the governments of Tunisia and Egypt. And actually, the government websites of Egypt stayed down till Hosni Mubarak stepped down as president.
Anonymous came in as sort of an adjunct cyber military force to aid the protesters in Tunisia and Egypt.
Well,
that's extraordinary. I mean, that's something that a government might have chosen to do.
I don't think it's something a government could have done because the events there occurred so quickly that only non-state actors like Anonymous really had the ability to act so quickly. And since they're decentralized, this was something I bet some people started. It got on the chat boards. More people joined in. The thing about the internet is that the users of Anonymous are spread worldwide. They don't have a home country. They have no idea who anybody else is, but they can affect events in any country they choose. They also hack the websites of the Syrian Defense Ministry and a couple months ago or maybe a year ago, and encourage members of the Syrian military to defect to the opposition.
See, this is extraordinary, and this is what Professor Nye was talking about. You've got such a distributed threat. I mean, anybody anywhere who's got the ability and who's willing to take the time can get good at hacking. I mean, I'm not minimizing the skill. I mean, but if you apply yourself to it, you can do that, and then can join this group. How do you join Anonymous? Do you sign up somewhere?
That's the thing. The membership for Anonymous is completely open. Anyone can really become a member if they so choose. And the members aren't all super hackers. I mean, they have lawyers, doctors, everybody in there, which is why a lot of their protests have become much more lawful than the physical world. Like for the Church of Scientology, they started lobbying to have its tax-exempt status revoked because they say it's, a for-profit cult, not a legitimate church.
Okay.
They've also done things like help out humanitarian groups. They created a site, Anonymous Iran, where Iranians can go and, complain against their government without fear of being censured.
Again, very, very political and very potentially damaging. Any final thoughts on Anonymous before we conclude?
Well, I have to say the most notable thing that they have done is, of course, hack Sony. And for all of you, people out there playing Modern Warfare with me, for 2 weeks we could not get online and play our PlayStation Network. Now, Anonymous has claimed it was not responsible for the two-week-long prolonged hack, although some people associated with Anonymous have said they are, which is really one of the faults with Anonymous, is since they don't control their own membership, sometimes opposing groups in the organization will do things that the whole organization does not condone. So it's almost impossible to know what they're planning.
Good heavens. Well, now we've reached the pinnacle of seriousness. The Sony PlayStation was hacked by Anonymous. I don't know if I'll be able to sleep tonight. Well, that's our show today, and thanks very much to Ben Harris for coming in and telling us all about Anonymous. Thanks very much to Professor Joseph S. Nye, Jr., the University Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard Law School. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.